Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic. And we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey everyone, welcome to the 233rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Cheston Kwan, Deanna Ivanova, and Kyle McConaughey. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enloe. Today we've got Ryan Connolly on the show. That's right, Mr. Film Riot himself. He's here to talk to us about the nature of building a DIY career on YouTube in public in front of everyone and how he's managed to level up step by step incrementally on his own terms. It's a really great episode. Ryan's been a person on our list for a long time, and I think we dig in on what makes his show special and the ways in which we kind of, as filmmakers and podcast hosts, define ourselves relative to Film Riot.
Yeah, I feel like we're putting together the holy triumvirate. We've had Ted Sim from Indie Mogul and Aperture. We've had Seth Worley from Red Giant and Plot Devices. And now Ryan Connolly of Film Riot. If you need to know how to do something, one of these guys would have probably already taught you how to do it. I was very excited to talk to him because we're on, you know, recording everyone over Zoom. And just seeing his face, like, in the same way that, like, I've seen his face on YouTube tutorials, like, a bazillion times was kind of pretty exciting. And I feel like he really enjoyed talking to us, which I didn't know if he was, if you do it for so long, like, you know, is there a question that you can still be asked about filmmaking and not be bored by it? And the answer is yes. And what I liked about talking to him is, you know, there's some people that you see teaching about film a lot and you always wonder, like, about their own personal pathway. And, you know, he's very transparent on his channel and he's made a bunch of like amazing, like big budget short films that he's encouraged his fans to more or less be a part of the entire process every step of the way. But it's still fun to see, you know, like Robert McKee and his screenwriting career and, you know, these various people who are experts in their field as teachers and seeing how they are applying it to themselves and seeing that they have the same like emotions you know, and trials and tribulations that the rest of us have as filmmakers.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We try our hardest to avoid talking too much about the nature of making a show like Film Riot or like Just Shoot It. But, you know, we can't help ourselves. There's not that many people out here doing the things that we do. Right. Separate from being filmmakers. Normally, you know, we get to scratch that itch of, you know, relating to and, you know, talking shop with filmmakers on a weekly basis. But now we've been doing this show for 5 years. It's rare to know someone who understands the ins and outs of making this other sort of meta product, you know, I think is really interesting. And so it's always hard for us to not want to just like talk about the nature of making a show like ours as well.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder if it is really just like the best way to procrastinate, you know, ever is talk about how you want to do the thing instead of actually doing the thing. But yeah, I mean, I can't think of another field or industry that connects technical things and artistry and storytelling and like emotionality as much as film does. So I think that's what makes making this show so fun, because we can lean into one of those things. We can lean into like how you make shot lists, and then we correct course by, you know, how to work with actors. Then we correct course by talking about what kind of stories are important to tell and like helpful for the world to even have, and unique voices. And it's just, I don't know, it's just an endless thing. It's like, what else is there in the world other than art, politics, love, and engineering and cameras?
Yeah, totally. And I think that Ryan does a really wonderful job of finding the things that he is curious about, the things he wants to learn more about, the skills he wants to hone, and building shows around those ideas so that he can then translate it into his filmmaking, and you can watch that progress in real time. And so that's a real treat.
One last thing he talked about, which I've actually been thinking a lot about since we spoke to him a few days ago, is this idea that a short film can look like a YouTube film, that there's this idea that something can feel YouTube-y or digital, and there's something that can feel cinematic and worthy of being on a big screen in a movie theater. And the difference is not necessarily the budget.
Without a doubt. Yeah, I think it comes down to approach and detail and timing. You know, I think a thing that we're constantly looking at and striving for in our own work, and a thing that certainly like you've taught me a lot about, is just like the finishing is everything. Taking the time to really dig in on every single detail, things that feel like maybe they're nitpicky or that no one's ever going to notice, that sort of stuff is the difference between something that feels like someone cranked it out on a low budget and put it up online because they've got a post schedule to meet versus something that is worthy of being in a theater. And I think as that divide grows, that's going to be the thing that makes the difference between feature films, I think, and the smaller scale projects, whether that's, you know, a Star Wars movie or an MCU movie or a Christopher Nolan movie, right? That's the difference at this point.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing I saw this morning on Deadline was that this movie that I did 3 visual effects shots on just won the Gold Lion at Cannes.
Probably because of those 3 shots, I guess.
I mean, undoubtedly because of those 3 VFX shots. They said it was a VFX accomplishment never seen before. But when I did the visual effects on that, you know, been doing visual effects for a long time. You know, we talk about it all the time. Oftentimes, and I apologize if it's too technical, but someone will send me like ProRes 4x4 files, 4K or whatever, and I do the effects on them and I send them back ProRes 4x4, you know, keep it in log color space or whatever, because we were trying to preserve the quality of the film. And every once in a while, someone will send me like DPX files, which means, you know, each frame has its own image file and they're kind of big. But when I worked on that movie, which is a real movie, it's like a Fox Searchlight film, they do not mess around. They are sending you EXR files. Like every single frame is like 150 megabytes. And they're like, do not mess with one thing. We have to have sessions about just making sure the color is not modified in any way. We work in this like linear color space. And the fact that I'm even using After Effects is almost embarrassing, you know?
I think it might actually be embarrassing.
Consumer level, Adobe product, as opposed to Nuke or a studio level product.
Right.
All the shots I did are totally invisible effects that no one would ever know.
Yeah.
Or even
know. Yeah, it's really like, it's the equivalent of like erasing things that shouldn't be there, but that only the trained eye would notice were there in the first place.
Yeah, and that's something I've noticed. You watch YouTube tutorials, like especially for visual effects and things, and they're like, oh yeah, you can just do a cut here. No one will notice this, and do this. No one will notice in a million years, and do this. No. But when you work on these films that are going to be up for an Oscar, every frame should be perfect. Like no one should be able to pause this frame and say, look at this thing that's totally wrong. Like, you know, they used to do back in the day with those Disney animated movies where the animators were sneaking in things, or even Fight Club has a few frames snuck into it, right? If it's a movie that's going to get acclaim and be like this worldwide recognized thing, people will look at every frame of your movie. And I think you make a good point that caring about every frame of your film is something that is different than what a lot of YouTube people are saying. Like, I need to have something to release on next Wednesday.
Right, right. And that's not about talent or skill or ambition. That's about release schedule. But there are muscles that you have to train to catch the things, those details that you're even looking for. I can remember earlier shots of mine where I was like, yeah, that looks great. This is the best shot I've ever done. And then you look at it now and you're like, oh yeah, there's like 45 things I would change.
Yeah. I constantly am like struggling with wide shots. Like I see in my mind, I have a location that's amazing. I mean, let's say like a convenience store. It's just a regular location, but you've seen beautifully shot convenience stores, right? And then I bring my iPhone and I take some photos at the location. I'm like, why does this not look like Shazam or something? Like, what is it? And I remember Rafi Fine, you know, who we both worked with in the past. This was years ago. He sent me a frame from like a John Woo film. And it was like just a guy sitting in the car with nothing in the background. And then he sent me a shot of something from one YouTube video he did that was like a guy in a car. And he's like, why does the John Woo one look so cinematic?
Why does it look good?
And why does mine not? Like, what is the difference? And, you know, it's hard to tell, but I was trying to kind of delve into like color science, the controlled palette, the depth of field, maybe their lenses. I don't know. It's subtle, you know.
But I mean, the problem is that it's all of the above, right? Like, if it was just as simple as like vintage lenses, bro. You know,
just then, gotta crop it 2.39 crop, dude. You're done.
Yeah, right. Well, and in film school, I can remember, or even younger, cropping it and making it all of a sudden feel widescreen. You're like, this is cinematic, right? This does feel better. This is a big step forward, and it's like an easy, quick one that you can do. And then you realize, you slowly learn, like, oh, there are so many other tiny layers and details. And I think that the advantage of working consistently and being challenged to do that better work over and over again, that's how you learn to see all of those tiny details.
Yeah. And you think, I mean, in casting too, like you start working with actors that have spent weeks thinking about their character, and you know, they're not like on set, like trying to remember, oh, wait, what was the line of dialogue? What was that line?
Okay. What happened
here?
Like, right. Yeah.
The dialogue's like not even important anymore. There, I just watched this movie on the airplane, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Mm-hmm. Insanely good movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's perfect like perfect for an airplane. Just like nice and tiny, lots of white noise. Were you wearing a face guard? I hope you were wearing a face guard. You're like fighting the reflection as well. Like
I had an aisle seat and I turned it on. It's like, this movie might have some graphic nudity.
Sure.
Or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was like, So I had, because of COVID, the plane was like mostly empty. So I like moved to the window seat to watch it.
Yeah, yeah.
So people in the aisle aren't seeing me watching all this nudity on
just
screen.
Like just a thoughtful lesbian love story. That's all.
So good. I don't know. I could talk about that movie for 2 hours. We could do a whole episode on it. But instead of talking about that, I'd love to remind people that we have a Patreon page.
It's growing by the week, which is really wonderful to see. We appreciate all of the contributions people are making, especially during these times. But it keeps the show going. We've managed to give our team little raises. We're bringing on more people as well. Our editor is doing even more work. And so that's given us the opportunity to expand the ideas and scope of what we want to do with the show, dedicate a little bit more time to booking bigger and better guests that still fit within the scope of what we're trying to do and what we're trying to teach everyone about. It's been really nice. Genuinely, I feel free to do more, better work on improving the show rather than some of the more nitty-gritty parts of just keeping it up and running. I also want to shout out Jeff Bearhand. Longtime patron, longtime listener, sent us a photo of him with some Just Shoot It stickers. And I know there's a heck of a lot more of you out there with those stickers now. I want to see some photos, everybody.
And so as Dre Babinski once complained to us that it's so hard to find our Patreon page, I'm going to tell you again, patreon.com/justshootitpod. Patreon.com/justshootitpod.
Thanks, everyone. We appreciate you.
And now, Ryan Connolly. Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker by email or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's Just Shoot It 50 off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes. Matt claims that you're the guy that invented using PVC pipes as dolly track. Is that true?
think so. I mean, if I am, I'll take.
Well, you certainly have taught a lot of people, metaphorically and perhaps literally, how to do a lot of those early DIY hacks, for sure.
Sure, sure. I did construction work with my dad before I went full time. So it was like after film school. My dad is an electrical contractor, and he would just, you know, run sites. And so after film school, that was like, you know, get that job and make okay work. And that helped me get my gear together. But that's working with all like MT pipe and PVC pipe and all that stuff. So it's like I had like a head for those sorts of things, because you're always running pipe in different ways and getting it to do different things that you need it to do. So once we started doing the DIY, it was always like PVC will probably work. So we made like so many things.
I'm more of an ABS guy myself, but you know, who's judging?
It's just a lot of pipes fell off your dad's truck is what you're saying, Ryan.
They may. There was many a time where my father was like, are these my tools?
Speaking of that, I'm like kind of curious because, you know, Matt and I, when we trying to figure out what we should talk about on the podcast. Part of it is just stuff we're curious about, but other parts are like what we think our listeners would care about.
And also what in the landscape of film education, where are their holes, right? Like you guys have certain things covered. Like we're never going to be Film Riot or Indie Mogul. So what will we be? What do we want to make?
Film Mogul.
Yeah, Film Mogul. Perfect.
But I guess, well, one of the things that I'm curious about your channel is because it's interesting to hear your construction background in a way, or your family construction background, because I would watch your videos, you know, I've been watching your stuff for years, and I'd be like, okay, cool. So I just need to get a miter saw and a blowtorch and a this and it. And I'm like, a lot of filmmakers don't really come from that background of having the shop. But also you're like, and you can get this for $3, this for $8, for $42, you can have this, you know, whole exploding rig or whatever and light your friend on fire. So it's clear that you, obviously you're not going to go get the $5,000 item, you know, and you're not going to spend $2,000 a day motion control rig, unless you're doing like a plug or you're showing people like what people use in Hollywood or whatever. Like, how do you set the parameters for yourself of what you think your listeners like can actually achieve? Is there a thought process?
And also, how has that changed?
I think, well, the kind of idea behind the show from square one, which, you know, I've said a bunch, but the idea has always been like what the opener said, which was like, you want to be a filmmaker, so do I, let's figure it out. And the idea is that it was gonna follow my career from super green, I have nothing, I don't have pennies to rub together currently, to, you know, hopefully making feature films. And that's kind of been the public, you know, journey, with the idea of fail publicly, succeed publicly, all those things. And we've done both. We've definitely failed big publicly.
How have you guys failed? Because I guess from watching your channel, I haven't seen that.
Oh, well, that's awesome. But I mean, there's, you know, there's stuff that we put out where I'm just like, that's not the best. That didn't come out how we wanted. Or, you know, episodes that were like, God, you could tell that we did that one fast. You know, there's that stuff where it's just not as good. But the real major failure that we had, that I was happy to be public about, because I thought it was a good message to put out. Because, you know, often it's like an Instagram world. Everything's perfect. All the messaging is perfect. It's nobody's fault. You know, oh, it's elevated. We're all elevated. It's elevated material. You know, it's like, what is everyone saying? You know, so back in 2013, it would have been to this day the biggest short film I ever did. It was called Outsiders. It was this like behind closed doors, like unofficial, yes, go do it by Image Comics to do like this side Walking Dead fan film. So it was kind of what they ended up doing, like, what was it called? Like Fear the Walking Dead, where it's like elsewhere. Yeah, yeah. That was kind of the idea of the short film.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like there's a zombie apocalypse, but there's a lot of pockets of survivors. So this is the story of one pocket.
Wait, and you had Image Comics involved in this, you're saying?
No, I had a friend there who was high up, and I talked to him, and I'm like, hey, could you talk to Robert and see if, you know, and he's like, listen, we're not going to go official on this, but yeah, do it and then show it to us. So it was kind of like, if they dug it, it could have, you know, so I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, so, you know, the pressure was
so you're on. Like, we're selling the house.
Yeah, we're selling the house, baby. Well, we got a bunch of sponsors on. We had one major investor in it who was like covering over half of it. And it ended up ballooning into this $300,000, 30 minute short film with like 100 plus zombie day, all in makeup, We had the guy who worked on Transformers building sets for us in Austin. We had, you know, makeup artist behind Resident Evil working, made tons of custom stuff. You know, I sent actors out to his studio to get, you know, all the prosthetics done, the whole nine. And then the Friday before the Monday, we were about to start shooting. And this was all very public. We did a whole live event, which we had like, you know, I think 30,000 people watching. You know, we pre-sold posters to help pay for the film.
Watching you on set film. And so, and I know I said I follow you and I do, but I kind of on and off, I might have like probably been a little off during this outsider's time. So this is, I'm very curious to hear what happened.
Yeah. So, well, the Friday before the Monday, we were about to start shooting. The money fell through. And so now we're not shooting. And it's I saw it coming. And
wait, but did you have the sets already?
Like, they were mostly built. They were almost done. And we like called them and like, hey, you could stop. You don't have to work over the weekend.
You're saying basically people were working as though money was in the bank, but you didn't literally have the
I lost
the check
a lot. Cash. I put it. I basically bankrolled it personally up front, like all the pre-pro. Was,
like you floated everything.
Right. And then, you know, the sponsor money would have offset that. But instead, I just lost all
that. Like, sell more LUT packs.
We need to do more in the store. But there were people like flying in, like in the air when I got the news. But, you know, and it was when it finally came through and we're on the phone, we're like, all right, let's pull the plug. It's, you know, because it's like, oh, the money should be there on Monday. And it's like, okay, we're not doing this. And like a huge moment of relief for me because the ship was already sinking and I knew it. And
wait, how many days was your shoot going to be?
It was 6 or 7.
Okay. So you couldn't have squeaked out on the fumes.
No. And there were so many things that like hadn't been done because the money wasn't coming in, but it was too, you know, late. The ball was rolling and so there was nothing left to do but pull the plug, call everybody and tell them, and then publicly on the show be like, yeah, so that thing we've been talking about for months now and we've done all these like pre-production BTS on and you bought posters, it's not happening. You know, and
were you were like the writer director on this, right?
Yeah.
And just to like take a step back, is the like in your head, Ryan, kind of like separate from Film Riot, is there an idea that like if this takes off, Image Comics joins us, this turns into a feature at Warner Brothers, whoever does, you know, Walking Dead, I'm moving to Hollywood and being a feature film director and passing off Film Riot type of thing?
I never want to fully pass off Film Riot. Like Film Riot, like my brother Josh kind of, you know, runs it for the most part. And we've been gearing toward that for a long time, considering that as I get closer and closer to the features, like that's going to happen. But I'll never like leave it. You know, I'll always, it's a major passion of mine. But that was, 100%. Like a buddy of mine, Dan Trachtenberg, had like 2 years before put out the Portal, short film. And then he made a movie with Bad Robot. And I'm like, and I knew he hadn't made 10 Cloverfield yet, but he had some major stuff developing and going on right now. And I knew that.
So you're looking at him and you're like, let's do it all in.
Yes. Yes. And I'm like, man, if I could, you know, if this could be a proving ground out of me as a director, and especially in 2013, that was still very much a thing.
You gotta admit, you look at someone like Dan Trachtenberg and he makes one short that's really awesome, we'll admit, but then you look at everything you've made, which all the things you've made probably add up to more than that one short, and then you see him get this deal. Isn't that infuriating?
No, not to me. I mean, I'm always just excited for friends, and he's just ridiculously talented. And the big difference between me and Dan is like Dan had done a ton of major commercials. He had done he did viral campaign for like Hellboy 2, I think it was, and different stuff like that. So he was already like, you know, he knew the process, he knew the people, he knew how to pitch. I was still figuring all that out.
That's an interesting, sorry to interrupt, but that's interesting to note that like, I think we think of him as like just what you read in Deadline or whatever.
Right.
As like
overnight
the guy that made
success.
Portal.
Right.
And then he got, 10 Cloverfield Lane, but like, the truth is he did like 100 things in between.
Exactly. And that's what I'm always talking about too. And that's one of the things I really love about Film Riot is because it's open and it's public. There's 11 years of Film Riot, you know, at 12 probably before anything really happens, that it's like, no, look at how long this took. And that was just, Film Riot started 5, 6 years, 7 years after film school. So there was even, and then, you know, we all did tons of stuff before film school, you know, for those of us at Winslow. So it's just all that time, you know, David Sandberg, everybody, he's the one that seems most like overnight, but he was still, you know, beating his head against the wall, you know, making short after short after short, putting in the work, trying to figure it out before, Lights Out ever took off. So there's always that,
Right. He's like the opposite. You know, he's like the guy that did Shazam and did these big movies, and he's like still, you know, working with his IKEA lights and making his short films and doing tutorials about his.
Also, we always talk about Shazam when we talk about him, but like, you know, Annabelle Creation, right, which was like this, the first after Lights Out was kind of like the first, like, you know, franchise property. Look, everyone listening and the three of us would probably love to do a movie of that size, but like it wasn't a big fancy payday, huge success, like, honey, let's pop open some Cristal and buy a new house sort of situation. You know what I mean? It was still, that's a small movie in a beloved franchise, but it wasn't like Shazam is like a, you know, a proper studio feature, but he had to have two other movies and a bunch of viral success before that, you know. So I think the point we're all making is that it's incremental, no matter how fun it is to talk about the overnight success.
Yeah. And do you think he would have gotten Shazam without the accent, like if he just sounded like a
never?
Yeah. No way, right?
That was the yeah. entire reason.
Yeah,
that was
he's yeah. actually born in Milwaukee. It's crazy.
It's all a facade.
I grew up in Israel, and I told my commercial reps, I was like, would it be helpful if I use like a Israeli accent, like a Hebrew accent on these client calls, just like as a joke? And they're like, yeah, can you do that? Anyway, never tried it. But yeah, okay, sorry, I interrupted you. So you were looking at someone like Dan Trachtenberg. You thought this, you do this Walking Dead spinoff.
Yeah, right. that was a real bummer of it is you know, that was a huge portion behind it, is obviously I was going to learn a ton from it. You know, it was the first time I was even going to work with a cinematographer. So there was mm-hmm. a lot of firsts that were going to come out of it. And, you know, if it went well and, you know, Image dug it and they pushed it, could have gone viral, which could have led to, you know, something else. But sure. that didn't happen. And I'm not mad that it didn't happen. Like, it taught me a lot, and I think it taught everybody that watched the show a lot, because, you know, as I've gone on in my career, and even as I told people that were a part of it that, hey, this isn't happening, and, you know, obviously I felt horrible, and they were more like, dude, don't worry about it, this happens all the time. And I'm like, what do you mean it happens all right. the time? But right. it you yeah. know, it does, nobody talks about it, it's all behind it. So it was like, it was nice to fail, you know, publicly in that way for that reason.
But also, I mean, you call it a failure, but you turned it into, like, it's like, kind of, you remember Rocket Jump the show, which I know came after you did that, but like part of the shorts that they made were, you know, they were fine, they were interesting, they're crazy, they're racing horses as if they're cars or whatever. But what was really interesting is seeing everyone sitting around the table pitching ideas and saying, like, could we get a horse to do like a power slide, you know? And you still had that.
Yeah, and I think the main thing I'm most proud of with that short is, like, it, you know, Film Riot's always been about, like, you know, just keep pushing and
rioting.
And we put our money rioting. Where our mouth is, because it yeah. fell through, you know, huge. And then we said, but we're not just going to cry about it. We're going right. to make something anyway. So it went from having $300,000, a huge cast and crew, you know, the several days to, well, there's this plot of land in the middle of nowhere and I have $300. What can we make? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember I just, you know, I emailed Andrew Kramer, Dan Trachtenberg, and Seth. And I was like, hey, can you guys jump on a call? And we just spitballed ideas until we came up with, like, oh, what about a shackle? And it's, you know, it's connected. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay. And then me and Seth went off and wrote
so
it.
So you just call Andrew Kramer like it's no big deal?
Juju, my baby boo. yeah, he's helped out on a couple of shorts. He's such a good dude, man.
Calm down, Oren. Calm down.
My heart is palpitating. yeah, it's, yeah. What's going on with him? Can he put something on videocopilot.net? Driving me crazy, that guy.
That guy, he's always doing like 100,000 things.
You're reminding me of, like, there's a period of time in the early, like, 2010s and really more like the early aughts where, like, the idea of getting, you know, exposure on the internet and then, like, turning that into a TV show or turning that into a feature career was what's much more viable, basically. You know, like, that was kind of what the landscape was looking like and the way that people were farming new talent, right? And since then, I think it's interesting, obviously, like, a lot of those places have shut down. You know, Oren and I did a lot of work for, like, College Humor or Funny or Die or all of those kind of, like, you know, web portals, or we both have Go 90 shows, you know, and all of that has gone away, right, effectively. And I am curious to see what the next wave of farm league sort of proving grounds become. You know, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, it's not TikTok, right? It's is it Instagram? I don't know. How do you build a following? How do you find people?
You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who have been doing it because I think, you know, there's that huge shift towards creator owned because I think people figured out that MCN was a thing and it was just a little, you know, icky to a lot of people.
By MCN, you mean the multi-channel networks when people were promoting each other and teaming up.
But also signing over their rights in a lot of ways.
Exactly. Right. I didn't know it was a thing until Revision 3 hit me up about Film Riot. And one of my rules is always if I don't own it, I don't do it until it gets the features. And then there's sure. no negotiating that way. But like, you know.
But you can afford to make your own YouTube series, right? You know, so like why sell it? Yeah.
Wait, but why? What if someone said we want you to direct an episode of Station 19? Like would that?
No, that's totally fine. But I mean, like, you know, this is my full-time job. You know, it's I've always tried to keep ownership, especially mostly if it's like I'm passionate about this thing, like Film Riot. I wasn't about to sign over any form of rights to Film Riot. So instead it was like I was on their brand. There was a revenue split. In the beginning, they got a much larger revenue split to it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I fronted the budget for the show. I did all that. And they brought in ads and they marketed the show. That was really the main, like, plus to an MCN back in the day is the marketing power that they had behind them and, you know, the network that they had behind them. So it was like, you know, the NBC of the internet, essentially. And they owned most of their shows. There was just like maybe two of us that owned the properties on there. And it also allowed me to be like, you know, when they came with a sponsor that I didn't want on the show because there's like 10-year-olds watching my show, I would be like, no. And I could do sure. that, you know, whereas all the right. other channels just had to be like, okay, I guess we're running this ad. So that was a plus too. And then, you know, it's gone with me. And then Discovery, you know, Rev3 sold to Discovery and that became like Group 9, which became Seeker. And, you know, now we're fully independent. And I think, you know, you've seen that massive turn toward the fully independent creator owned type stuff. You know, I think it just takes whatever that one thing is to kind of hit, you know, like Peter McKinnon did. He had that thing that hit and then he just rode that wave smartly and just and grew it that way. And then there's other channels that just they kept at it. I think we're kind of like a channel sort of like that. We had a nice like, you know, springboard in the beginning, but it was just, you know, we've just kept at it for like 11 years. So I think that's kind of, you know, mainly where we're at. It's less about, you know, bigger corporations and more about like, you know, the authentic individual, at least for me and what I care about. You still have, you know, those massive channels who definitely have things behind the scenes going on, but I don't really watch that stuff, you know, the reality TV of the internet type stuff, you know, not bashing it. It's just not sure. my cup of
sure.
tea.
It's just complete garbage. It's fine.
It's pure poo. But then as far as like, you know, you make something to hopefully get that turned into a feature. As far as my experience goes, that's still very much a thing. A few of after Ballistic, that's really, I mean, every three or four of my shorts have went out, got some, you know, recognition. And some calls came
some heat on this piece of talent.
I never really pushed too hard for them because I didn't sure. feel ready for it, but Ballistic was like that was like a specific effort of hopefully this is going to open doors because I really want to push this time. And it did. And I talked to a few producers and these were very large companies and all of them said the same thing. They had a department that their job was they watched short films online and passed off what they thought was good. So they're very much like still looking for that sort of stuff. And there's a couple of producers that I know now that are constantly, and they're even like, hey, send me anything you find. Cause they're constantly looking for IP to snag and, you know, try to take that dude. Cause here's your proof of concept. It's already done. You know, sure, that right. lights
and
out.
And we didn't spend any money on it.
And we didn't have to spend any money on it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It still seems very much like a lot of people are still looking for that lights out effect, but you know, it also definitely seems heavily toward very genre specific type stuff, you know, you know, heightened concepts, horror, sci-fi, action, that kind of stuff.
Well, that's great. That what a perfect segue. It's like you have a podcast. Cause the other thing I think we want to talk about is, you know, you've been drawn to genre, right? Like I think you kind of grew up in this world where like, you know, there's like action, horror, sci-fi, supernatural sort of elements to all of your work. And specifically, I think taking that idea and then also your background in teaching people DIY filmmaking, how do they kind of cross-pollinate? How do those streams cross? And how has it affected you as a filmmaker?
How does DIY like go into genre, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. How do you approach the genre elements knowing that you've got kind of this Swiss Army knife of different ways, you know, you can pull out the old rear projector or the, you know, the goo gun or whatever, you know?
As far as genre goes, I feel like story always, you know, kind of dictates what genre it's going to be. It's like, you know, I don't think any of us are like, I'm going to make a horror movie. I mean, I guess some people might be, but, you know, it's not, I don't really set out to, this will be horror. It's kind of like you get an idea and, well, of course that's horror, you know, mm-hmm. and then I just chase that. And I think I love genre because it's such an exclamation point on ideas, you know? So like, mm-hmm. that's why I love horror. You could take like this very thematic idea, like, you know, Hereditary, Relic, and you could really put that hard exclamation point on the thing you're really diving into. Whereas, you know, with drama, you're more staying very realistic. With horror, you can really, you know, and oftentimes life feels horrific. I mean, we're 2020, sure, for instance, sure. You know, 2020 is one long horror movie. Yeah. So I think I'm drawn to it for that reason. And as far as the DIY element goes, I think that's just been really helpful across the board, just for, you know, filmmaking in general, you know, because mm-hmm. I've never had too much of a budget. Like Ballistic had a decent budget to it, but even in Ballistic, you know, we had 100 people on set for the action stuff, and there were times where I'm like, we're running out of time, get me that board and grab me that thing, and then just constructed this thing, and it was like, you know, a couple people were like, that's never gonna work, and then it worked perfectly and we're like, great, moving on, you know. So that stuff even to this day really helps. And I know we were talking about David Sandberg, he's told me about things that he's done on set where it came from, you know, I did this one time in my apartment with my wife, and then that's how they did it, because hey, we don't have the money, but we could still do this just by doing X, you know. All my friends have stories like that. Even, you know, DPs I've talked to, you know, have stories. I just, Shane Hurlbut has, you know, that he's talked about plenty, that, you know, big long piece of wood with bulbs stuck in it, and it's one of his favorite lights, and mm-hmm. you know, it's a homemade thing. So that DIY aspect has made things possible for me. But even when I had resources, it was really an amazing thing to have in the back pocket to, you know, problem solve quickly. And I think, you know, one of the reasons we like to teach the just do it at home, grab your iPhone, whatever it is, you know, we call it the filmmaker toolbox all the time on the show, because you're just constantly shoving those ideas that you've tried into that toolbox mm-hmm. and, you know, moving aside the ones that you tried that didn't work. And the more you do those things, the more you build up, you know, those ideas in your back pocket, the better you're going to be on set, the more valuable you're going to be as a filmmaker, because you're, mm-hmm. yeah, that's what filmmaking is. It's constant problem solving, you know, right. and shifting gears. Well, that doesn't work. And 50 people are looking at me saying, now what, you know, you got to think quick and come up with a new thing. And I think that's what's great about experience, and why experience is so important, and why I've waited so long to really push hard for features, is because I wanted to have enough of that experience. And I think DIY is really like one of the biggest educators for that, because you are like we were talking about, you are grabbing PVC pipe to get right. things done, or strapping a firecracker to someone's right. chest with a metal plate.
Well, and it's nice, you know, it's going to work, right? You come from a place of authority. So I think sometimes when you level up, sometimes you'll have producers who are like, I'm sorry, Ryan, we can't afford squibs. And you're like, well, I know how much a firecracker and a metal plate costs, so let's figure it out. And that's maybe a bad example. Just having that as, you know, a way of reassuring yourself that you know a couple different ways to do it, and like not being hindered by the quote unquote right way sometimes, right? Because there's a lot of people who are like, wow, I don't know, that's not how you do it in Hollywood, all the time. And it's the worst.
There's been a few times where I was on set with somebody just helping out. Like I did a second unit directing on one thing, and it was a very large project, a couple million. So everything, union, everything by the book. Sure. This is a legit like full on LA thing. And there were so many things that I can't even count how many times I said, just give me the camera, I'll do it. Just let me do sure. it. Just hand me it, I'll do it. You know, it's like, but it's like, I don't feel safe. Yeah. And I'm like, what do you mean? There's literally no reason to feel unsafe in this situation. Just give me it, I'll do it. Like one was somebody had to run to a helicopter, and the cam op didn't feel safe. And I'm like, the actress is running to the, how do you get in a helicopter? You run to it. What do you mean? Like, just take the camera and walk to the helicopter.
Yeah.
So it's like stuff like that, where it's like, you know, of course, safety is key. We preach that on the show all the time. But these were, you know, you had an amazing stunt coordinator standing there going, what are you talking about? There's no issue here whatsoever. And it's like, you know, that's their job. So it's like, you know, stuff like that drives me nuts. So I totally relate to that. But like, even trying with the DIY, trying stuff in post and practical, I think also teaches you quite a bit, because then it's like, you know, we're running out of time. We don't have time for the practical. You know what? We could do this digitally. I know we can. Let's just shift and do.
Sure.
You know, adding that to, you know, the post can be DIY as well, like in a weird way. I've always used After Effects in a very DIY sort of mindset. If you ever watch my tutorials, now they're getting a little more legit. I have a VFX artist, Ryan Thompson, and he does them now for the most part. I just host it. But whenever I do it, you can tell, because it's very, you know, bubblegum and popsicle sticks. It's just like.
Yeah, but that is After Effects. It's like. I feel like Andrew Kramer's famous for like just building everything out of a solid, right? But I guess what I'm curious about, because I think about this all the time, is like, can you be too DIY and kind of like exactly for what you're saying? So when I started out, I think like everyone else, I did have the PVC pipe dolly. I had my own PD-150 and then the DVX-100 or whatever. And, you know, shooting stuff with my roommates and jumping off roofs and being on top of cars and all that stuff that's fun. And we're making all these things.
And we don't recommend.
And we don't recommend. And, you know, and I had like all my own C-stands and sandbags. And the car I got was built to be a car that I can shove a bunch of C-stands and sandbags in. And at some point, I'm like, I don't want to carry fucking C-stands and sandbags anymore. Like, I'm over it. Like, when am I going to get to the point where I show up and somebody else has picked up, like, you know, I would go to Wood and Nickel or whatever, and I have to test every light, like, and check things out and get the insurance in place. And I was like, I want to get to a place where I don't have to even worry about that. And I'm not buying cameras and lenses because I want to be, you know, the director. And I don't want to be tied to spend $80,000 on this red Scarlet package that's worth like $4,000 the next year, you know, and be in the rental business and be in the gear business. And now that there's this pandemic and, you know, all of a sudden everyone's like, hey, can you shoot everything by yourself with your family acting in it at your house? And I'm like, well, I do have these C-stands. I'd prefer not to carry them into my house. But, you know, now I'm like kind of miss that DIY life. But I also have been in that situation many times. And I know, you know, I have a lot of friends that have worked with the Corridor Digital guys, right, that I know some people, they're just kind of so entrenched in the like, can't I just grab the camera and run over there and do this? That it's very hard for them to work with like a big union crew. You know, our friend Tony Ascenda, who did American Vandal, he said when they were shooting a scene, there was like a fireplace in the apartment they were shooting in. They just wanted one that you can turn on with a light switch, you know, and it's a natural gas fireplace. And he's like, wanted to turn it on. They're like, yeah, we don't have the fire marshal here. We can't turn that on. And he was like, are you insane? And I don't know. We've all been on a stage where we're like, oh, what if we just put a couple candles there? And they're like, open flames. Come on.
A slight tangent. One time, I shot I've told the story on the show before, but I shot some cat food commercials in Moscow in Russia a little over a year ago now. So we've got a cat running around, right, that we like flew in from some other, like if it was from Sweden or whatever. We're in a warehouse in Moscow and there are fucking candles everywhere and a fireplace that we built. And I kept asking, I was like, is there like a fire safety officer? And they were like, we don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, well, how does the fireplace work? And they go, oh, we'll show you. And they walk me around the corner and there's just a short man in like, you know, like some dirty clothes with a propane tank and a flamethrower, like a little blowtorch. And he would turn on the gas and then he'd light it up and they'd be like, you have to cut in about a minute and a half because he has to turn off the propane. And he was just back there, just like turning it on. There's no chimney. There's just a little man with a little flamethrower, and that was
and
that.
And they're like, by the way, KGB agent says never use fire and safety in same sentence. But so I guess to that point, like, do you figure out a way? Because, you know, I'm sure Dan Trachtenberg isn't lighting his own fires and things, but David Sandberg probably is. How do you go to that level where you're not the guy that's like, yeah, just take a drill, connect it to that chair, and it'll spin, you know? Is there a way where, like, you disconnect your mind from the DIY thinking? And
yeah, do you turn that off when you're on a bigger set?
Maybe it's just about having people you trust.
It was definitely a learning process for me. Like the first few times I did stuff with a legit crew and people who actually knew what they were doing, and I didn't have to do the things or worry about the things or, you know, do the bubble gum and popsicle sticks. Like, we're doing it like how you would do it. Oh, okay. You know, yeah. Even when we did Ballistic, as early as Ballistic, which was 2 years ago, there were moments where I was fully going DIY with it, where it's like, well, you know what I could do? I could just put the camera here. I could do that. And one of my producers is like, Ryan, if you want these cars moved, we'll move the cars. I'm like, what do you mean? They're all broken down cars. And I'm like, yeah, we're bringing in a forklift. We're going to move these cars wherever you want it. Tell us how you want this this place set up? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? I can just tell you however I want, and you're going to do what I want. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, okay, put that car there. And they're like, you got it.
And,
I'm
like, and you're like, okay, where's the forklift? I'll drive the forklift.
Totally. I was like, all right, so I have to get here early and do it. Sure, like, sure. Oh, wait, no, I don't.
I've got some skis. I'll duct tape them to my car. And then.
Yeah. So it was even with that, there was a moment where my stunt coordinator was also my producer. And he was like, dude, just tell me what you want. I'll be the one to tell you if we could do it or not. And then we'll go from there. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, it is a weird transition for sure.
Because there was even a moment where my actress ends up breaking a window to get something out. And originally she just opened the door in the script because, you know, my thinking.
Sure, right.
Of course, we're not going to break a window. But we get there and it's like, I had the idea of like, man, it'd be so much better if she broke that. Like, why would it so dumb that she would open a door?
So 2019.
Yes. So I was just like, I randomly was like, I wish we could break the window. I'm like, of course we could break the window. Which one? This one? Yeah. And then hold on, let me get it. And he pulled his effects guy over and he's like, hey, can we do that? And like, yeah, no problem. I'll just put a squib here and here. And yeah, not a problem. We'll do it. I'm like, okay, so we're just going to do it now. We're just going to break. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. And by the end of the shoot, my brain was thinking more in those terms where it was like, hey, I want to do this. And so it was a bit of a learning curve. And I had already done some stuff before then, but that was the highest level of like, hey, we have trucks filled with stuff just in case you want something.
I remember the first time I asked a producer like if they had lunch taken care of. And they were like, yeah, dude, of course. And you're like, oh, I should be directing. I should be thinking about the scene, not double checking that my crew's going to get fed.
Dude, you never did that. Yeah. You went to film school, USC. You guys are, as soon as you come in there, they're like, what would you like for lunch, sir?
I would, the first short I ever had where I didn't do those things was my last short, There Comes a Knocking, which was last year. And that was the first time where I was just like, you know, yeah, the producers are going to handle that stuff. And my brain was able to kind of shift into that other, but it's taken years to kind of realize that it's like, oh yeah, like, they'll do those things and they're good at those things and it'll be better because they're doing it. But I will say, even in There Comes a Knocking, even though I've gotten used to that, there were several times where I busted out a DIY solution because something wasn't working or, you know, oh geez, that doesn't look good. We thought it was going to, and it's still low budget. We don't have time to do like camera tests and stuff. So it's like, that doesn't look good. So it's like, all right, you know what? Let's light it like this, shoot it like this. And I know I can do this in post to fix it.
Invention idea. You make a hat, it says going DIY on it. And like whenever you're on set and you're like, it's time to switch gears.
Yeah, yeah. And then all the union guys just turn around. They just stop looking at you.
The other side of the hat says, I trust
you. They're like, uh-oh, Ryan's touching the camera.
Look away! We're not.
My follow-up question though, the tricky thing about getting used to other people taking care, like experts doing their craft, right? Is that sometimes you're inspired by limitations, right? Sometimes because you're used to doing everything yourself, you know, you don't move those cars, but you find a really cool angle because the cars are now a foreground element or something like that. How do you kind of deal with the other side of that? Like, do you ever find yourself being complacent in terms of problem solving? Like,
no, I mean, I think that, you know, as filmmakers succeed and go, you know, larger and larger, you know, like, you know, David had Shazam. Now you have something where you have a whole lot of resources. And I think in those areas is where it gets dangerous of like, I could do anything. Like this could be a full CG shot. And then I think that's where it might get difficult. But, you know, for me, at least every project I've ever done was nothing but problems. And like, how the hell are we going to pull this off? And and I do like to make myself uncomfortable. I've talked about that on the show a lot as well. You know, if I feel like, yeah, I got it in the bag, no problem, I don't really want to do it because I feel like you would kind of be complacent. You would be like, paint by numbers. I'll just. And we did a short called Sentinel forever ago, and I really did it just so we could show a certain thing. And every short I've done over the last like 6 years was very specific toward, I want to test myself in this way, or I want to learn this. Like, you know, ballistic, I worked with stunts in a way I never had before. Lots of practical stuff, wire pools, like crazy stuff like that, action in a way I hadn't done before. And Sentinel was like this, you know, invisible, you know, this ship that we're putting in later. But, you know, because it was such a short, like, guy goes from here to here, some action happens piece, I decided I'm not going to write a script. I'm just going to bullet a few things that I know are going to happen. I didn't really see the location ahead of time. I didn't do a shot list. We're just going to go zero plan, and we're going to put this together on the spot. Because, you know, that happens even with a full plan. Everything's like, well, we're not shooting that anymore. Now what do we do? So I thought it was a great way to, you know, to test myself. And because it was very, it was something that was a little paint by numbers for me. So it's like, I know how to do this. Like, I know exactly how to make this. And I always get a little worried when I feel that way. Like, I want to be terrified that I'm going to screw this up, you know? And Ballistic was nothing but terror. and even though we had like a good amount of resources, it was like $100,000+ short film in the end, we still pushed beyond every, you know, ability we had. Like, it really should have been a 300+. I can't remember the number that my producers told me, but it should have been something like 350, 400, something like that. And we did it for like 120 in the end, something like that. And lots of favors, obviously, lots of figuring it out, still like DIY approaches in each department of its own kind. So I have not experienced the, you know, limited resources thing that I still have had. Because even like the car moving thing, as awesome as it was, then after I moved like five cars, my producer went, okay, so I think it's important to tell you that every time we move a car, it costs us $200. And I'm like, oh, gotcha. Okay, so don't move that.
You're like, if we forgot to order lunch.
Yeah, I hope you're okay with Chipotle.
Yeah, even with that, there was still, it wasn't just like, it was like, okay, we have to move these cars because we're going to construct this PC. And so, you know, I completely agree with you. Like, those limitations, I always appreciate them because, I mean, even when conceptualizing something in the beginning in pre-production, if it's like, you know, right now I've been developing a few things and there's some stuff where it's like, you know, here's a concept. Okay, we want that concept, build out the story. I was like, okay, great. Well, this concept could go a billion different places. And so one way that I've always whittled that down is by doing just that, even in story form, is like, okay, here are my limitations, and then build out around that. So I kind of have that process no matter what, even in pre-production where there is no limit, the limits your imagination. So I think I'll probably always do, I hope I always do that and keep that mindset. But so far I have not had that issue. It's always been, how the hell are we going to pull this off?
Other than Film Riot and like doing these shorts, which are kind of like, I seem under the umbrella of Film Riot because you're teaching your audience everything you're learning, everything you're doing. I mean,
and
I kind of feel like
it's a built-in marketing engine, right? Like you're dissecting all of the different audience things. Like, oh, like the wire poles and Ballistic, let's talk about how we did those. Sorry, you were saying, Horn.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm just curious, like, is that the audience is awesome. I think there's that model where like I make a short film and five people see it, but four of them work for studios, and then the short is a means to the big project that pays a lot of money and gives a lot of prestige. So I'm curious, I know we wanted to originally talk about like kind of the things you do and what you've learned and all that stuff, but I'm really fascinated by your personal career here and like the trajectory, like, because what you've built is awesome. Like, I could see you doing Film Riot forever, making bigger and better shorts and bigger and better things. Do you care about like directing commercials for other people, pitching TV shows, writing, doing the non physical filmmaking stuff? And I know obviously you write and you talk about story and you talk about things. I'm sure you own many story clock workbooks. What's your dream? And I'm curious also about like how Dallas, like living in Dallas, plays into it.
I hope I do Film Riot forever. I hope that never goes away. And you know, I am very lucky in that, you know, what are the odds that I'll succeed in the ultimate goal of making feature films the way I want to make them? Like, that's, it's, you know what the industry is. We all know what the industry is. And if nothing else, if all I do is Film Riot for the rest of my life, I'm still making stuff for an audience. I'm educating, which has turned out to be a passion of mine, which I never expected.
Right. And you have a successful business too, right? Like, I mean, I guess there's the financial stability part of the filmmaking that many of us are chasing in various ways.
Exactly. Like, Film Riot's been such a blessing into, you know, sustaining me financially while allowing me to do some, and you know, it's a business and it's all the pain in the ass stuff that comes with a business, and you know, to where you're doing 80% of the stuff you don't want to do, but 20% of the time, at least it's 20%.
Sure. But that's also filmmaking. Like, that's the thing that I don't think people understand. Like, even when you're making especially when you're making a studio feature, right? It's not like, well, now I just get to shoot all the time, and that's the only thing I worry about is making a good movie.
So much politics involved behind the scenes with even just trying to get something made. Sure. It's crazy. But yeah, I'm writing right now. Commercials, no. I mean, I would do them. You know, I have done some stuff, some client stuff in the past, you know, pay the bills. But overall, unless I have to, I have no personal interest in commercials. It's just not really my thing. But, you know, features is for sure where, you know, my main, you know, hopes and dreams lie, you know, is just make those larger movies. And I mean, in a perfect world, it would be go off, make a movie or two with studios, get that experience under my belt, and then, you know, come home to, you know, Triune, which is my main company, which does Film Riot, Mothershow Variant, the store and all that stuff. And then just start making my own movies, you know, with, you know, no one to answer to at all except for the audience. Right. That would be like, you know.
Is there an example of someone that's done that you can point to?
I mean,
Rodriguez, right? Kind of.
Yeah. Like everyone in Texas, man.
Richard Linklater,
Terrence Malick, Sandra David Lowery. Blake. You know, like there's a lot of dudes who make their studio movies and then like get to hang out. And
yeah. And like something like with a model of Film Riot where it would be like, you know, completely detached from that sort of stuff. I feel like there's a different way, you know, if things worked out well, there would be a different model of getting the finances to make the thing, even that would untether it, you know, from, mm-hmm. you know, all the madness, you know, answering to any, like, this is the story, this is what I'm making. Cause I've already experienced just pitching and developing and that stuff. It's like passionate about something and no one sees what you see. And you're like, God, you're nuts. If you could just see the thing, you know? Yeah, and sometimes it's like, you know, there was something I was pitching and everybody was sent to really responded to it, but everybody who got it passed on it. And a couple mm-hmm. people were like the beginning of the call, just gushing over the thing, love the thing. And I'm like, okay, so is it not a pass? Like it full on felt mm-hmm. like, wait, are we talking about doing this? And then it was like, so anyway, but you know, fortunately that one's not for us. Let's talk about it. And I'm like, you what? And then sure. what I found out is just, it wasn't straightforward enough. It wasn't mm-hmm. It's a drama for the first half and a horror in the second half, and it's like, you know, there's not a ton of things to point to that, and that's not a definite like money maker. And it's like, okay, I get that, but it's like, but you're just saying that you loved it and it's the type of movie you want to make. You know what I mean? Sure. But it's like, yeah. you know, it's still business and they still got to sell it and it's still got to worry about its return on investment and all that. So getting to a place where you could just decide, you know, with, mm-hmm. like, I'm just going to make it, which is kind of the thing with, you know, a couple of the films that I got going. Like, I'm working on developing some stuff now, but like, I'm kind of, you know, I have an arbitrary date in my head of this. If nothing moves, I'm just going to figure it out and make something for like, you know, 100, 200, whatever. Just make a feature. Just enough is enough and just go make the damn thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to ask, right? You hear the budgets of these awesome shorts that you're making, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, well,
you can make an okay feature for $350.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, the tricky thing, right, circling back, is that the genre of it all, action, wire pull, like, could you make a good movie, even a great movie, with about a bunch of people talking in different locations that you could probably get for free? 100%. But that's not a Ryan Connolly movie,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah,
right.
yeah. It would have something. It would have yeah, to have yeah. some. But I have some stuff that it's like, it's all genre. I am like heavily a genre filmmaker. I got a couple things, a couple of ideas that are kind of outside of that, but not really. It's mostly genre, sci-fi, action, horror. I have one comedy. So it would be that, but I have a couple of things that it was like, you know, I think we would need, you know, $1 million, $2 million, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. you know, I think there are avenues toward that, but you know, that brings in a whole new level of, you know, pain and punishment because I've been the studio, quote unquote, mm-hmm. for my short sure. films. And once it balloons to a certain level, when it has to, if you want to hit a certain level, the moving parts are nuts. And to be the writer, director, producer, and studio of a thing is, it's just a lot. And to do that mm-hmm. in a feature arena before ever doing one just is like, you know, I'll do it if I have to, but I know how painful that will be and how difficult that will be. And so if I could just focus on being a director or writer director, mm-hmm. like that would be preferred.
My prediction is that you would not be happy with just doing those two things.
Probably not.
Yeah. But I do have a pitch for a Ryan Connolly film. Basically, in the first 10 seconds of the movie, all of time stops. You know, kind of your tutorial where you guys are in the bedroom and everything's not moving. And basically, the entire movie takes place in that one moment. And just the two people that are still moving have to figure out how to get time going again.
That's pretty good.
Not going to lie, that's Ryan actually Connell a pitch movie. That's being worked on.
No, it's not.
All it's right. not well, exactly we'll... that, but I'll just say out, that then? It does have to do with freezing time.
With that tutorial?
Well, it's not that specific tutorial, but it's a very much time is frozen in like the entire planet type of thing, and only a few people are not frozen.
Oh, that's awesome. Can I tell you how many commercials I've done where I'm like, they're like, that does it. How are you going to do that? I'm like, Film Riot, this is how we
this
do it.
This is how we do it.
Yeah. Like, I've shown your stuff to so many people to prove to them that it's doable.
Look at this YouTube idiot can do it. We can do it.
Well, it also helps them understand the process, right? Like, you hear like Frozen in Time and you think of The Matrix or something. And
yeah, ILM.
Yeah.
We don't have ILM budget.
Right. And it's like, no, like, these are the different elements that we're working with. And maybe we do a little bit of bullet time or something, but it's not 300 cameras, it's 4 or whatever. You know, just breaking down the fundamentals helps people understand what it is you're trying to do, basically.
Yeah, it is interesting that we've gotten to a place where the people who don't know think that everything's this massive David Copperfield illusion, where it's still a lot of sleight of hand. It's all close street magic, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess that's the DIY thinking. And it all still works really, really well. And for me, it's some of my favorite stuff. Just like, I think even David put out a video recently where it's just talking about the power of a cut, where it's like, the cut's the effect. And that's a great example of that sort of thing, where it's no more than literally a cut. I mean, Looper, they're like, time travel is literally just a cut.
I've watched that transition in like slow-mo to be like, did they do any, like, a little bit of like warping and scaling? Are they like, is there like a 3-frame like time warp out of any? It's a hard cut.
Yeah,
they're like, oh, did you forget to put the VFX shot in? just leave it.
And sometimes it's like that restraint, that minimal approach makes it so much more grounded, especially for that film. It did for me. It felt like, you know, if somebody did just cease to exist, that's what would happen.
My last thing is just, I can probably ask you questions all day long, but do you, about the location thing, like, do you anticipate, like, you have a family, right?
And, you know, 4 times as much space as we do, right? Like, you know, like, you've got a lot of space in Texas, right?
Yeah, but we've got more fires.
Yeah, so that's true. We got
not
you
everything's
beat there.
Bigger in Texas.
Yeah.
It's been really helpful to live in Texas. I mean, that's one of the reasons we went, because, you know, the cost of living, you know, out in California is so high.
Were you in LA before Texas?
No, but a lot of my friends and some family were. And, like, you know, when I came down to Texas the first time, and it's because I used to go to New York and LA a lot, and I could just pop up to LA in 3-hour flight, be there, you know, if I need to for whatever. And very small business friendly in Texas. You know, you have Austin, which had a good film community. Dallas was starting to grow. Now it's got a pretty decent like indie film community. So that it really made sense for all the reasons I specifically needed. And you drive 3 hours this way, that way, or that way, you get totally different looks. So, you know, some of the shorts we would have done, I used to live in Florida. There was no way we were going to do any of that in Florida. And Florida, the cost of living was a little higher, not as friendly to small businesses. You know, when we first moved out to Texas, I rented a 4,600 square foot house, 4,800 square foot house. And, you know, I had a bedroom and the kitchen, and the rest was like the studio. It's like, you know, there were several people working for me, and we just used the house. And I was paying less than my cousin was for a 1-1 in LA.
Sure.
So it was I can't sustain that and do, because I wanted to stay as independent as I did and as nimble as we were, to where it's like, shift on a, here's a new idea and shift the whole thing. And if, you know, the overhead was that intense, we just wouldn't have had, you know, the flexibility to do those things, or to, you know, save every extra penny and shove it all into a short film or whatever it was. So that really made a lot of sense for the trajectory that we were on, especially because Film Riot was, which is the whole reason I was able to do that, is lucking out with Film Riot, is because it, you know, it is its own thing. That's a web-based thing that could be its own pocket wherever I wanted to be, and it'd be the same thing. So I also recognize that, and I'm very thankful, you know, that worked out for me, that gave me the ability to be able, you know, to go anywhere. Cause otherwise, you know, you kind of got to go to LA or something like that.
Yeah. Do you still have ties to, I mean, obviously you have a lot of friends that work in Hollywood. And I mean, I remember like freaking out when J.J. Abrams you know, recommended video copilot.net in Wired magazine. And then next thing we knew, like, Andrew Kramer was making titles for Star Wars, and he was kind of swept away into the, like, sucked into Hollywood. Do you have reps, like managers, agents? Like, does Film Riot have reps? Like,
Film Riot does not. Like, everything in my company, I keep completely independent, separate, its own thing. What it seems like is really exactly what it is. If it seems like we're just shooting in my house, just me and my brother and no one else is there, that's literally what's happening. It's me and my brother inside of my house, and that's it. You know, and I really like that about the show. It's like, you know, we'll scale it over time, but I always kind of want to keep that super indie charm to it. You know, even I want to bring more people, more voices, more faces in, but I always want to keep that lightning in a bottle backyard sort of filming in there, you know, because I kind of what we were talking about before, I think those sorts of limitations make you think, you know, well, we have cardboard boxes, I bet you we could do it with that. You know, we turned a cooler into a dry ice machine to make fog all over the floor and worked great, you know, that sort of stuff. It's like, because we don't have a studio and all these like crazy things or whatever. So that'll always be a part of the process. But I do have reps. I'm rep by 3Arts. Luke Maxwell and Will Robotham are my managers, and I've been working with them since Ballistic, which that all came about in a funny way. Of long story short, Ballistic came out, got a bunch of production companies and producers hitting me up about developing a feature, and I had never gone to the like this point, like it jumped past points that I've been at. So I'm like, I don't really know how to handle this. Do I talk to everybody? Is this like cheating on a girlfriend with everyone? Like, do I tell them about each other? And I'm like panicking. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know. But I literally got like five people telling me, hey, I would like to develop this with you.
And you're like, oh, I really click with this person. They seem to love my movie.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, but do I have to pick? So there was somebody, another friend of mine connected me with like 2 years before that. And he was like, I believe he was an assistant or an intern. I don't remember. I think he was assistant at 3Arts. And I was like, oh, you know what? I remember him. We just called and we're like, hey, this is me. This is you. Cool. Maybe we'll talk one day. And so I found his email and I shot him an email like, hey, this is going on. Not to bother you, but any advice at all that you have about how to find a manager would be incredible. And he's like, funny enough, I'm a manager. Can you send me a short? And I sent it to him and he's like, can we get on a call? And then, you know, he brought Will on and we really, really hit it off. And then, you know, I started working with them developing it outside of production company so we could really develop it into a thing and then take it out to the town.
Right.
And I've been working with them ever since. And, you know, I've learned a ridiculous amount from them. So that's been a great experience as well.
Yeah, it's crazy how that story, it sounds ridiculous. Like, I just kind of contacted a person that happened to be a manager and they just repped me after I sent them one short film. But it's like, it's kind of common, you know? And
that's the smallest version of it, right? Like, you probably were Facebook friends with him for those 2 years, right? Beforehand.
No, that was the only touch point. Only touch point. We had that one, we emailed and then we got on a call, we chatted, liked each other. And then for 2 years, nothing, silence.
Right, right. But I'm saying in between you guys chatting and then him signing you, right? Like, he at least tangentially, he's aware of you. Or even if you're still working for those 2 years, he can like do a quick Google and be like, oh, Ryan's up to some cool stuff. It's not like literally just Ballistic is the only touch point.
Like, would he have cared at all if it wasn't for that first call? I doubt it. I don't know. Right. You know, it's like, you know, it's a great thing with like those first generals that you do is just you're getting on people's radar. So then when my managers are like, hey, Ryan has this new thing, they're like, oh yeah, Ryan, he was a cool dude. He wasn't crazy. He didn't seem too weird. Right. You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But even that was sort of funny because even when I talked to 3Arts, I was like, oh, thank God, managers, they're going to help me, you know, guide through this. But I didn't know that a manager also kind of acts like a producer in some ways and helps you develop material. I didn't realize that fact. I thought they were more agent-y. Yeah. And so they're talking about developing this thing and I get off the thing and because, you know, 3Arts produces as well. And so I was like, oh my God, that's just another producer. I still need a manager. I ended up being able to get in contact with this other guy who is the manager of a good friend of mine. And me and this manager have become good friends ever since. An amazing dude. And so he's like repping me now. And then like a couple of weeks later, he's like, I tell him something that the guys at 3Arts say. And he's like, dude, they're managing you. And I'm like, no, they want to. What do you mean? He's like, and he's like, they're currently repping you. And I'm like, no, they're just producing it. And so he's like, okay, go back and ask them. And if they are, no harm, no foul. I totally understand. So I went and I asked them, and they're like, yeah, of course. That's what we're interested in Ballistic right now.
Do you
now.
Think we're just nice?
Yeah, we're interested in your career. We want to help you do. And I was like, oh no, it's not. I had to go back to my the other manager and be like, dude, I'm so sorry. I've wasted your time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, no, it's fine. They were working with you first. They want to take big swings. He's like, let's just stay in contact. And we've been friends ever since. So I was like, thank you so much for understanding me. It's for understanding and letting me off the hook.
Yeah. And reasonable too, right? Like, it's rare that anyone ever like looks you in the eyes and shakes your hand and says, I'm happy to be your new manager, Ryan.
And it was definitely a hip pocketed situation in the beginning, whereas now like I'm repped. Like I could say, those are my reps. Before it was like, you know, which is totally understandable too, is like, are you a waste of my time? You know, can you handle
Let's
this?
Figure it out.
Yeah. Cause it's also like when I connect you with somebody and put you in a room with somebody, are you going to be able to handle yourself? Or are you going to embarrass me? Cause you know, they're putting their name on the line. Like that's the major value of a manager and an agent is their name.
You put their logo on your script when you send it out.
And I've looked out with really great managers, whereas like so many CEs that I've talked to have mentioned like, oh, I adore Luke, everything he sends, I make sure that he's got great taste. And so that is the great, you know, massive, massive help with that is like people are, oh, Luke sent this over. Oh, okay. I'll definitely look at that. Cause I get so much crap on their desk, you know, but yeah, it's been such a weird twisty turny. Like there's always a new layer of like, oh, that's how that works. Sure. That's weird. Yeah. Oh, I get it. That's it. You know, it's like one of my first calls. It's such a stupid thing. I'm sure you guys are going to be like, you idiot. But I didn't think that, hey, I should have other ideas ready to pitch on this call. I just thought it was like a, hi, we're friends now, you know?
Right.
And by the end of the call, it was like, I was like, oh, I see what just happened. That was the point of this is like, you like me as a filmmaker. You don't want that, but you want to hear what else I have. Damn it. And it was like one of the bigger ones that I've talked to so far. So I was like, blew that.
But you know, it's funny. I think there's a recurring theme that we hear, Ryan, and like Oren and I live through this constantly. Like even sometimes it takes me like months or years to be like, oh shoot, that's what they meant. And like, it's not like anyone only gets one shot. You continue to build connect. Like if you quit, then that's your one shot for sure. But like building connections, putting things out there, like testing the waters with people, like you're going to make those mistakes. And because sometimes people unintentionally are unclear about things, sometimes because they're trying to just be nice, you know, or sometimes just because the, you know, things aren't clarified to you for whatever reason, like that, it's not like it's the only chance that you're ever going to have at any of that stuff.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, if nothing else, you had that connection and if you clicked and hit it off, and you know, because you talk story, you talk movies that you like, you talk passions, and you know, if you connect and it's like, you're not weird, I'm not weird, okay, you know, that's it's like you were talking about before, now you're on the radar. So you know, it's not worthless. And if it goes well enough, there's been several where, you know, personal contact information, but hey, check the chat. I'll put my, you know, direct email in there. So if you ever have anything you think I'd be interested in, you know, send it my way. So, you know, those doors open as well. So now it's like, it's not just some random person being like, please look at my script.
Right. Yeah. I think we hear in like the TV world all the time that like people are buying you, not really your script necessarily. Right. They want to hire the team that can pull this off. And I think we don't think about it in the feature world as much, but it is true. It's like if someone's not into your project, like you shouldn't be offended. If they're into you and they say, what else do you have? It's like they're investing in the relationship with you as a filmmaker and not with you as a script.
Yeah, totally. And that's like a part of the, you know, a lot of people are like, what's my guarantee that this won't be, my idea won't be stolen? It's like, you have none, but if they like your idea enough, they want the well, not just the water, you know? Yeah. It's like, cause there's probably more in there like this and they liked it enough. And if you're the original source, it would. So yeah, I've definitely, you know, clicked on that as well and have kind of chased that idea. I think it's really useful to, a friend of mine said it something about pitching where it's like realizing you're the train. You know, a lot of people are really nervous because it's like, Stu Mashowitz, and I think Seth is the one that actually told me this, but it's like, you know, you go into these meetings thinking that they're the train that you need to get on to be able to do this thing. But in reality, you're the train and they're always looking for one they can jump on. And that has helped quite a bit. And having that mentality of, you know, obviously not douchey, obviously, you know, having humility. And,
yeah, you don't walk in, you're like, hi, Ryan Connolly, the train.
You're going to want to jump on this, buddy.
Choo-choo.
Not in a weird way. Yeah. But like, you know, just having the mentality of like, I would love to do this with you, But even if you say no, I'm still making it. Like, I'm going to make this eventually. Do you want to make it with me, or is it not right for you? And just having that mindset of it helps get away from the very easy trap to fall into, at least for me, of like, they don't want it, which means it's not good enough, which means I'm not good enough, you know, and you start slipping down that filmmaker depression hole. But just having the confidence of like, well, I'm going to make this either way, kind of, you know, at least helps me avoid those traps that do, you know, creatively slow you down.
Yeah, that train metaphor is so good. I mean, that's why your manager signed you, right? Because it's not like you said, hey, here's my short, what do you think? You're like, hey, I made this short, it's got all this interest from all these people, things are happening with it, I need someone, a conductor.
Yeah, there's definitely like the hot person in the room situation, you know, like it's like you create the illusion that everybody wants to talk to you, or maybe it's real or whatever it is. Like, that's like the game of it all, right? Is like, you know, oh, everybody's talking to that person, I guess I should be talking to that person, you know, which is funny because there's, you know, incredibly talented people that don't have heat on them. And it's like, dude, if you just pay attention to that one, you know, you see it all the time. But yeah, that's definitely an aspect to it. Just that hot person in the room idea.
Well, listeners, may you all be trains that people want to hop on.
Yeah, sexy trains.
Well, awesome, Ryan. It was so great talking to you. Are you down to join us for some unpaid endorsements?
Yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement is the film Day Trippers. Do you guys know the Day Trippers? It's Greg Mottola's first film. It's like straight up indie New York.
Is that based off a graphic novel? Because there's a graphic novel that I love called Day Trippers.
I don't think so. This is just like everyone's home for the holidays. It's Hope Davis and Parker Posey are like sisters. And then like they're staying at like their parents' place. And Liev Schreiber is the boyfriend to Parker Posey. And we realize that Hope Davis's husband is cheating on her. And so their day into New York, into the city, becomes kind of a little caper to like figure out what's going on with Stanley Tucci. And it's really great. It's super funny. It's super charming. It's got that kind of external plot driver, but it's really funny. It's really charming. The cast is incredible, you know, and it cost... Back in the day, it was like nothing, basically, and was, I think, the first Slam Dance premiere, basically. And so it's super charming. It's on Criterion streaming. You can buy the disc if you would rather do that. But the Day Trippers, I just found really charming and fun. Ryan, what you got, buddy?
The latest thing that I could think of is actually something from a friend who put up a doc he made. It's like this hour-long doc called My Brother Jordan, which it's a documentary he made that took him 8 years to make about his late brother, his life, their relationship. And it's just this, you know, I know him, I love him, he's a very good friend, but even if I didn't, I think I still would have considered it one of the most honest, like heartbreaking, beautiful documentaries I've ever seen. It's just a really beautiful, it's like one of those things where you watch it and at the end, you kind of just want to, you just want to be a better person. And there's so much perspective wrapped up in it. And he very much made it as something to talk about and remember his brother, somebody who he had an incredible relationship with and bond with. But in doing so, he either intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know, crafted this thing that so specifically pointed out how much of an effect one life can have on, you know, every life around them that they touch. And his brother absolutely was that person. And it's actually, it hit off. It's been doing really well. He put it on his own channel. He didn't really have any subscribers and it's just taken off. I think he just cracked a million views on it.
Wow. On YouTube?
Yeah. So a lot of people are starting to connect with it. And that's been, you know, I told him today, it's like one of the things I'm most excited about is just seeing that, you know, Jordan, his brother, like, you know, is, you know, still touching lives. Like the effect that his life is having on people now by watching this, that like kind of like I keep calling it this gift that Justin gave to the world to, you know, introduce the world to his brother. So that would be mine. I just thought it was incredibly well made. I loved how he just technically how he put it together, but emotionally it's wonderful.
I think I saw the trailer for it after seeing you mention it on your channel. I wonder how many people have like a loved one die that's like did these amazing things in life and they're like, I need to make a documentary about them. And then like the next day they're like, what's for lunch? Let's go.
Yeah. And it's something that Justin has care because he actually used to work for me. He worked for me for about 3 years and he was working on it the entire time. And it was tireless, man. Like we were like, hey, we're all going to go do this. And he's like, I'm going to go home and edit. And it was just every night just going home and working on this thing. It was like such an intense, it's not something he threw together quickly. It really was 8 years because he went around interviewing people, gathering footage, gathering, you know, hospital documentation, everything that went on, cut, recut, sent to people, got notes, cut, recut. And it was just, super proud of him. It was an incredible achievement. And I couldn't be happier that it's getting the recognition that it's getting. But definitely, if you haven't watched it yet, couldn't recommend it enough.
And it's just anyone can watch it on YouTube.
Totally free. He spent 8 years of his life and just put it out because it was just important to him to, you know, because I was even like early on, I'm like, dude, let me help pass it around. Maybe, you know, maybe you could get it on Netflix or something. And, you know, he looked at it someplace and he's like, man, I just really want everyone to see it. So I'm just going to put it out there for free.
Yeah, that's pretty wild, man. That's pretty great.
That's awesome.
Kaplan.
You asked me if I had seen the documentary Boys State because, you thought that I would like it.
Was I right?
Yeah.
Boy, I loved it. And I was like, oh man, I'm overselling this.
Maybe you oversold it a tiny bit. I'd give it like an A-.
Yeah, so that's a watch. Yeah, yeah.
It's a documentary that's exactly about what I spend 90% of my day thinking about.
There's a reason I texted you.
Have you seen it, Ryan?
Is it on Netflix?
So this is my useful tidbit. It's on Apple, and I didn't realize that so many people didn't know that you get the Apple TV Plus for free if you've bought an Apple product within the past year. iPhone, iPad, laptop, desktop, and they have, you know, their library is okay. They had the morning show, which was, I don't know. I watched the whole thing. I thought I'd give that a solid B. But Boys State is a documentary you can watch for free on Apple. So you can also do a free trial.
Yeah, you get a free week trial if you haven't bought an Apple product in the last year. And also, I think it's only like $4.99 a month if you want to stick it out. So not so bad.
Yeah. You probably don't.
I don't find myself going to it much.
Yeah. It's not the same sort of...
I also find the naming convention is like confusing because it's like your Apple TV on your Apple TV. And when you go to the app, like you can see all the things that are not on Apple TV and you don't know what costs money, what doesn't cost money. Anyway, but so Boys State, it's this event that happens once a year. I think it's for high school seniors. They do a Girls State also, but this documentary...
They're working on a sequel, Girls State, actually.
They always do the boys first. Not cool, guys. But it's basically the documentary is about all these boys in Texas, and they take all like 2,000 boys or 1,100. I heard both numbers mentioned, and they split them into two groups of like, let's say 600 each, and they assign you a party. You're the Federalist Party or the Nationalist Party. And then people decide what office they want to run for.
And what their platform is, what they stand for, all of that stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, they have to campaign. They have to get signatures to be on the ballot. And they run for mayors, for city state, for campaign chair. And it's because it takes place in Texas, your home state, it's all these 17-year-old boys. And the only two issues they care about at
all. I
think
I know what's coming.
And it's like, what does a 17-year-old boy care about abortion? Like, I don't know. It's just so weird. And then guns, like, they all just, like, love guns in just a way that is odd to me. I mean, to me, it's also odd to, like, the right to choice, right to life. Like, when I was 17, I don't know, that, like, I just was not thinking about it. I was thinking of surviving the next day.
Yeah, exactly.
I was trying to figure out how I could get a set of Reebok pumps.
Yeah. Dude, yes.
But anyway, they end up kind of, the characters that they follow end up being kind of two of the candidates that are running for governor, a few of the candidates that are running for governor. And they're really, you know, there's some really moving parts to it, but I just thought the dynamics of the politics were really interesting. And you can't watch anything political that doesn't remind you of this Trump kind of the idea of identity politics on the left versus showy like attack politics on the right, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Which is like, you know, that's thematically, I think, what they were hoping for.
Yeah, and it's constructed a little bit, which is why it gets the minus.
Right, right. The thing that I always love in a documentary as a filmmaker is when you're watching it and you have that moment where you're like, oh, they just got so excited that this thing happened. Like the thing they were hoping for, the plot twist that you didn't see coming or maybe they were hoping was going to come, happens. And I think there's a good number of twists in that movie that are pretty satisfying.
Yeah, and the election results are pleasing in a story way. You know, there's a lot of conflict and there's things you don't expect and things you do expect. But it's awesome. Boys State.
Boys State.
I've been on a documentary kick, so I'll probably watch
it. Yeah, boy, who hasn't, right? I feel like that's everything we're watching. I'm going to tack on real quick. The filmmakers behind Boy State were on The Business with Kim Masters and do a really great interview about their casting process and how they kind of got things greenlit and all that, because it was a pretty big deal out of Sundance. And so that interview we'll post as well. Yeah. And is super good as kind of like a combo.
To shoot an event with 1,000 miners.
You know? 1,000 miners all in 7 days. So they had like 6 camera crews running around and like, but all, it's all about the prep work that they did in advance to figure out like who they wanted to follow. Not every single kid that they followed ended up in the movie. There's a lot of interesting facts about it. So,
and it's also a beautifully shot doc, and it's shot on C300, which I was like, it looks like it's shot on, you know, like a Alexa. With film lenses and stuff. Cool. Well, I think we know how to find out more about you, but is there anything not Film Riot or Triune that where we can see what's happening with
what's
you?
What's the deep cut of Ryan Connolly?
No, I mean, just, you know, filmriot.com is where we've been putting everything. We've got the podcast. We've got a blog now going. But yeah, pretty much everything that's public is still, you know, funneled right through there. Hopefully there'll be something eventually. Else, sure. But you know, for now it's funneled there.
Awesome. Well, if you want to learn more about the things that we talked about, you can go to justshootitpod.com for all of the things that we name dropped this episode, along with links to Ryan and myself. And you can follow us on social media at justshootitpod. I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And I'm at Smitey Pileg on Twitter. I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. Our social media director is Derek Aiello. And the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.